So, welcome to today's edition of Cover to Cover with me, Paula Wiseman. So, joining me on the phone today to talk about her brand new book, Daisy's Gift, is the author, Claire Guest. So, welcome to the show, Claire.
Hi, good to speak to you.
Cool. Now, so we got this press release, basically, about this fantastic new book, and I kind of knew as soon as I saw the press release that we had to get you on the show. Such an amazing, amazing story. Do you maybe want to start off by telling us a little bit about this incredible story?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, for me, the journey's, you know, been about my relationship with dogs and finding out these fantastic things that dogs can do for people, which, you know, we already know, but I don't think we realise the potential of it. I was a psychologist. I was trained at university as a psychologist and felt very passionate about the relationship with dogs and people and worked in assistance dogs for many years. But I was also very, very interested in dogs' sense of smell and the fact that, you know, they seem to love nothing better than smelling at things and how we might be able to tap into this. And I had a friend and colleague whose dog warned her about a malignant melanoma on her calf when she was in her early 20s. So, you know, this was a young girl, no reason to be concerned about this little mole on her calf. Mm. But this pet dog kept on and on licking and sniffing at it. And eventually she went to a GP, had the mole removed, and it was a malignant melanoma. And there were many stories like this around the world that were actually written by Dr. John Church in the medical journal The Lancet. And a number of years after that, we got together to see if we could train the first dogs in the world to actually be trained dogs to see if cancer had an odour and dogs could smell it.
It's incredible, isn't it? Absolutely incredible. Mm. So is your dog Daisy, anyway, is kind of like, obviously, the story is about. Had you had Daisy for long before all this happened?
Yes, well, Daisy, you see, I'd already done the first study training dogs to do it just before I got Daisy, actually. It was published in the British Medical Journal in 2004, and it was after the success of that study, and it's actually one of her predecessors, a lovely dog called Tangle, who's also in the book, who sort of proved that dogs could do it. But when I picked Daisy as an eight-week-old puppy. She's a beautiful eight-week-old puppy with great big brown eyes.
Yeah.
But I knew that, you know, the role that I wanted her to have, if it worked out, that she was going to be the next generation of cancer dogs. And she started working on a second study with the local hospital.
Yeah.
But it was during this second study that this rather remarkable and unusual thing happened, that she started to behave a bit strangely around me. She warned me about my own breast cancer, which was not part of the script.
No, exactly.
It wasn't what I expected at all. But not only has she shown that dogs are very capable of sniffing samples and indicating that cancer samples, and has gone on to do this for a number of years, but she's also saved my life as well.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, so is there any explanation? Has anyone kind of managed to work out why dogs are reacting to this? Is there some sort of connection we have with these, with dogs or?
Yeah, I mean, there's a good scientific reason. So, you know, it's not sort of something that you have to have sort of faith to believe in, if that makes sense. Basically, whenever we have any illness in our bodies, there's a biochemical change in our bodies.
Right.
And in the case of cancer, you know, there's a cell change. And these different biochemicals smell different. Now, dogs have got this, you know, incredible sense of smell. I mean, Daisy will have something like 300 million sensory receptors in her nose. She's a Labrador. I've got 5 million in mine, and you know, we think things smell bad, don't we? So if you think that in terms of dilution, Daisy could smell probably a teaspoon of sugar in two Olympic swimming pools. Us humans could smell it in a cup of tea. You know, we're talking about a very, very, very sophisticated sense of smell. And in addition to that, of course, they've lived with us for centuries now. They live as a family group, and they want to protect us. So I think there's an element of noticing the odour, but also knowing that it's perhaps not something that's good, not something that's good to have. And therefore, the combination means that some dogs actually do warn their owners.
Yeah, I mean, you get all the drug dogs and things in the airport, you know, and they're literally smelling something, and they can. It's amazing, you know. Just this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that with the dogs that we currently work, you know, on our at the charity for the biodetection side, the cancer side, and we're also looking at Parkinson's and malaria. These are dogs that work in a similar way. They're going out and finding odours in samples. And they, you know, as you say, they love doing it. I mean, to them, it's a great game. You know, you smell something, you look for it, you find it. When you do, you get a
get rewarded.
Reward.
So, yeah.
The only difference with our work, which makes it a bit more difficult than the dogs, is that with the dogs and explosive dogs, you've got that odour to start with.
Yeah.
You can say to the dog, hey, this is what I want you to find.
Right.
In our work, we never know whether there's an odour there or not. In fact, what we've got to say to the dogs, I'm going to give you lots of different samples, and we're hoping there's a difference.
Yeah.
And we have to train the dog, a bit like me training you to find a red flower in the left-hand corner of a Monet painting, for example. It's that complicated.
Oh, my God. No mean feat, is it? So, I mean, do you want to tell us a little bit about your own background? I know you're involved in, like, science and animal behaviour. So do you think your work impacted on and it kind of helped with this whole process with the dogs?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been a real journey. I mean, apparently ever since I was sort of old enough to make any intelligible noise, every time I saw a dog in my pram, I would start sort of screaming and waving and shouting dog. So my parents were a bit bemused by this because they didn't actually have a dog. We didn't have a dog at the time. And
yeah.
So it was obviously something that was there in me, and that I sort of went and you know, developed, and we've got family pets, and then I sort of knew I wanted to train dogs. And the whole thing has been like a journey, because, you know, I started working, I was very lucky to go to Swansea University, but the early research was being done on the fact that, you know, if you take a dog into a nursing home or you stroke a dog, you know, it can lower your blood pressure and heart rate. And that was really new stuff at the time, really exciting. And it's really evolved from there. You know, I became involved in assistance dogs and knowing that dogs could help people, you know, with hearing loss or other problems. And this just developed. It was like a sort of understanding that, you know, dogs could actually do this. I think sometimes when I see dogs alerting people to low blood sugars, which is what the other side of our work does, and they tell somebody that their blood sugar is so low that they're about to go into a coma, the dogs do it effortlessly. Honestly, it's just like such a natural thing, and they warn them and they tell them and bring the medical kit, and the person does something to take some sugar and is prevented from going into a coma. And this is clearly something that dogs have wanted to do for us for centuries.
Mm.
I mean, they've clearly wanted to do it, but us humans, we haven't noticed, you see. And I suppose it took some difficult times in my life, and one in particular had a very, very traumatic marriage breakup, and was as low as it is possible to get, to be honest. Mm. But it's through those difficult phases in life that you become a bit more aware of what's going on around you eventually, not at the actual time of the lowest bit, but, you know, you start to look at life differently, and that gives you an opportunity to forget some of the things that have controlled the way you've thought for many years, and actually look at things in a slightly different way. And I think that's also what led me to sort of be able to do this work.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you know from a young age that you wanted to work with animals? That was going to be was what you were aiming towards?
Yeah. Well, my main concern was how I was going to do it, because when I was growing up, you know, you were either a vet or they really, you know, other than sort of working in kennels, there wasn't any much in between.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would have really liked to have been a vet, but didn't get the top science grades I needed, and then was a bit sort of, wasn't sure what was going to happen next, actually. But luckily just developed this, well, had got this huge interest in behaviour, and behaviour was just taking off at that point.
Yeah. So you have a charity called Medical Detection Dogs. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How did that all come about?
Yeah, so that came out of this early research. So the early research in 2004, you know, this is clearly work with huge potential. And there's a lot of scepticism, you can imagine. You know,
people,
what's all this about dogs sniffing a disease? And how's that going to work? And, you know, ha, 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 we can't have a dog sat in every doctor's waiting room. And that's never what we anticipated. We always anticipated that we'd be doing research to back up the detection of disease through odour, and also placing dogs with individuals as assistance dogs. And the charity was actually set up in 2008, so we're a relatively young charity.
Yeah.
We've already now got a number of research projects running. We have bi-detection dogs, as we call them, that are trained to either smell cancer or soon will be trained to detect malaria and Parkinson's disease.
Mm.
And these dogs we have a no kennel policy. So this is one of the things that was incredibly important to me right from the start, is that any dog that worked for the charity would not go into kennels. And that's because, you know, I've worked as a behaviourist, I've worked with dogs in kennels.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be honest with you, most dogs don't like kennels. You know, they want to be with us. And so I was absolutely sure that any dog that worked with us would have a fosterer, you know, have a home, a family to live with, and come into work on at 9 o'clock in the morning, go home at 5, and that's what we do. And then our assistance dogs, We placed the first assistance dog in 2008, and that was a diabetes alert dog.
Okay.
And since that time, we've now got 75 dogs working around the UK.
Wow.
And a 2 to 3 year waiting list. So, you know, it's really expanding. We've now got 40 dogs in puppy walking. And to be honest with you, we need to grow more quickly. I mean, it's... you know, we've got more work than we can actually do at the moment, so we need to grow.
Yeah, you see a lot of dogs in training. Do you know what I mean? When you're out and about, you see people with dogs. They're obviously sort of training them how to interact with their their owners and all that kind of stuff. It's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're just learning now about the new things that dogs can do for us. Mm. It's incredibly exciting.
So we talked earlier about this. You've got this thing called face blindness. Can you? It sounds really. You know, how would you explain it to people?
It's really weird because when you're a child, of course, you don't realise you've got it. You think everybody views the world like that.
Yes, so exactly.
If I meet someone, I remember them, if I can, by the shoes. As a child, I used to often look at the shoes they're wearing.
Right.
Which is a very, very bad way for people.
Unless you've got one pair of shoes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I was constantly bewildered by the fact that everybody else could recognise people. But basically, I mean, funny enough, there's been a bit of a feature on it. There's a feature on it in the BBC recently.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I can tell that people look different.
Right.
It's not that everybody looks the same, but I can't recognise anybody. And it to learn your face, for example, if I met you,
yeah.
I'd probably have to meet you, well, definitely between 5 and 10 times,
right,
depending
okay.
on how strong your features are. So if you've got very strong features, like you had unusual hair or a great big wart on the end of your nose, which I'm sure you haven't, but if you did, then I would probably recognise you quite quickly another
right.
time, because I'd remember wart equals... you and
yeah.
then I would probably I wouldn't remember your face, but I'd think, oh, that wart is you.
Yeah.
And that's how I learn faces. I learn faces by features, which
yeah.
is fine unless the feature changes. And the problem is that people cut their hair.
Yeah.
They go brown and in the summer and they look different. They wear their makeup differently.
Mm.
They do a whole range of things to confuse us poor people with face blindness.
I'd say it's probably more common than people think.
Yes, supposedly it is. In fact, I think the program was saying it was incredibly common, but I must admit, I haven't found many people with it to the degree I've got, although I did, you know, there are people apparently that have got it so badly that they never remember a face. So, you know, faces to them always look new. And just to explain, it's not, you know, people often have a feeling, don't they, if they've met somebody, they think, oh, I've met you before, but I can't think who you are.
Yeah.
It's not that feeling at all. This is the feeling of your face. You are completely new to me. I've never seen you before in my life. And then they say, actually, you've met me 10 times. Like, whoops.
Yeah, so is it a different kettle of fish with dogs? You know, obviously.
Absolutely. And I wonder whether, I mean, I've got no scientific evidence for this whatsoever.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wonder whether it's because part of my brain isn't working quite as it might.
Mm.
That actually I have a slightly better ability of reading dogs' behaviour. Because when I look at a dog's face, and this is the really strange thing.
Yeah.
I can almost tell what it's thinking, and I can't work out whether that's because just over the years I've learned it, you know, by doing psychology
yeah,
for a long
yeah.
time and behaviour, or whether it's something that's a bit more inside me, and I think it's something a bit more inside me. I can just sense what they're saying through their eyes and their face. Sadly, I can't do it with people so well, which is why I'm surrounded by dogs at home.
You've got quite a few famous patrons for your mm. charity and ambassadors. How does that all
yes,
happen?
Absolutely.
How do you make the connections with these your patrons?
That did take a long time because, you know, when you're a new charity anyway, and when certainly when you're a young charity doing something which is a bit off the wall, you know,
yeah.
I'm certainly the mad dog lady for a few years, it takes a lot of time to, you know, establish that this is evidence-based, it's proper work, we're doing it properly, we're going about this in a way that, you know, true research, true evidence-based. But we, over time, you know, started to get a lot of interest in our work. And I suppose one of the key points was that Betsy Duncan Smith, the wife of the politician Ian Duncan Smith,
mm.
actually had a cancer diagnosis the same year that I did,
right.
breast cancer diagnosis. But hers was found much later than mine. I got a very deep-seated breast cancer, which, if it hadn't been found, would have had I'd have had a very difficult prognosis
for that question
because it was so deep. Betsy's unfortunately wasn't found as quickly as mine, and she didn't have a dog that warned her, so she had very, very intensive chemotherapy. The chemotherapy in itself nearly killed her. So she was very aware of the difference, you know, of having an early diagnosis and a later diagnosis makes a huge difference. And in fact, that's key to survival. That's why people die of cancer. Treatment is so good these days. But if you don't know you've got it until later, then your survival is, much lower. Survival rate is much lower. So she didn't want to come and see us because I think the last thing she wanted to do was is come and see some crazy people who said they could take train drugs to smell cancer. She did come along and she was really taken with it. And of course, with our joint experience, both having gone through the process of surgery and lymph node removal and radiotherapy, you know, there was a connection there. And it's like anything, once you've got somebody, some people believing in you, you can then move forward very, very quickly. And she spoke to a number of people, and of course, we were very, very lucky eventually to have a royal patron. It's absolutely fantastic to have Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall as our patron, and she's been here, she's seen our work, we've taken the dogs to the palace, the dogs have demonstrated, and I mean, what a incredible, I mean, that was a sort of pinch me moment, in front of Prince Charles and the Duchess demonstrating with Daisy, and in front of a sort of prestigious group of people, and you have to just sort of think, This is really happening. But it's like, I say in the book, it's like ripples in a pond, really. I mean, I think, and going back to the fact that I had this very, 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 very deep depression following my marriage breakup, it wasn't that it was easy. And if somebody said to me now, do you think you'd be able to do all this? I would have said, my God, I couldn't possibly do all that work. But, it's all about ripples in a pond, isn't it? You start a little ripple and then people join you, and you talk about what you believe in, and people come and work with you, and it becomes a wave, and then off you go.
I do believe it's definitely easier to talk to people who have obviously, it's good to have people there that have been through a similar thing. Sometimes you find that people that haven't necessarily been through it don't really understand. It's difficult to explain.
Try to understand, but it's not quite the same as actually having felt that yourself. I think that's the thing with all things in life, isn't it, that we only know our own perceptions,
exactly,
but the more we can share with others, the better it gets.
So going back to the dogs, do you find it's only certain breeds? Does it matter what breed you like? Are Labradors more able to do the job, or are there like spaniels you obviously see as drug dogs and things in the airport? Do you find there's certain breeds that are more in tune to this kind of thing?
I mean, for the anecdotal stories, these stories that people had, pet owners, the stories they had, I mean, you found a variety of breeds doing actually, and often what was quite important was that the dog was very close and had a very strong relationship with the person, and therefore was with the person a lot, sitting with the person. For the dogs that we use in the biodetection area, the cancer dogs, we tend to use, as you said, Labradors, Spaniels, some working Collies, Spaniel Crosses. And that's because they're the dogs that love to look for things with their nose. They're always wanting to sniff and find things, and they really enjoy it and get reward from it. So these dogs never tire. They just love coming in, having a sniff around. And to them, that's exactly what it is. You come in, have a sniff around, get rewarded and go out, and then you want to come in again, and you want to come in again. So actually, for them, they don't get worked anything like up to the level that they potentially could. I mean, they've still got sort of, by the time when they go home, they've still got plenty of energy. For the assistance dogs, we tend to train a lot of Labradors and Labrador Crosses because they make very good assistance dogs. Because they go places, go in public places with people, and they're very happy and enjoy being around people. But we've still actually got, because the odour on a person, if you're making a detection on a person, then you are making, it's much easier in fact than making a detection from a sample, because that person's sort of, the odour is coming out of that person constantly. So we've actually got a couple of Yorkies that do the job incredibly well.
Oh, wow.
And we've got an Affin Pinscher, which is a little like Dennis the Menace type dog. And we've got, just like Dennis the Menace.
Yeah.
And we've got some crossbred dogs. So for that work, It's more about the relationship and the personality of the dog, provided it's a dog that likes using its nose.
Yeah, yeah. You don't see many chihuahuas, do you, doing detection?
I think they probably could, you know, some of them. Because, you know, some of them, I mean, they're very close to the person for a start, you know, they tend to be carried, don't they? Obviously, the more we breed a dog with a pushed in nose, the less well, sadly, his olfactory system works.
Mm.
So some of these small breeds are affected by the fact they actually can't smell as well as a Labrador could.
Yeah.
So.
So how did this book come about? Obviously, you don't sort of wake up one day and think, oh, I think I'll write a book about my experiences and stuff. How did it all start for you with the book itself?
Well, people say to you, you ought to write a book.
Yeah, you should write a book.
And you think, and you think, yeah, I should. I suppose, to be honest with you, one of the main reasons was that, Tangles passed away. He passed away last November.
Yeah.
So he was the first dog that did the BMJ study. Daisy's, she's 12. She's on a bed beside me here on a very comfy memory foam dog bed. And, I really wanted to tell the story while Daisy was still with me.
I can't explain
exactly why I felt that, but I wanted to. Yes, I could have, you know, done it in years' time, you know, many years' time when I had more time, but Daisy wasn't there. But I felt the very strong wish to tell the story while she's still here.
Oh, she's gorgeous, though. The picture on the front of the book. She's a beautiful dog.
Yeah. She just had a picture taken this morning, actually. So, you know, I wanted people to learn about the story while she's still here.
Yeah, definitely.
I can't explain that, but I just did.
That makes sense, doesn't it? So how did you go about getting published? Yeah. Obviously, that's not... It's all well and good, do you know what I mean, putting a book together. But how did the whole publishing thing work? How did you get a publisher in the end?
It's for somebody, it's unknown waters for me.
Yes, exactly.
Completely confused by lots of it. I was, lucky in the sense that because the story that I was sort of telling about the charity is relatively high profile, you know, people take an interest.
Yeah.
So I was introduced to someone who actually said, you know, I really do think this could make a good book, and I was not really sure, because, you know, actually I think a lot of people will feel this, you know, when it's your life and your experiences, you live it every day, so it doesn't really seem that interesting, does it?
Yeah.
And he said, no, I really think this would be a book, and it was actually, we were the charity was supported by the Telegraph Appeal, you know, the Telegraph Appeal.
Mm-hmm.
They have a Christmas appeal, and we were really, really privileged to be one of their chosen charities. And it was when I was talking to one of the journalists, they said, look, I know somebody who would be really interested in this story, and put me in touch, and it went from there. So luckily at that point then I was sort of guided in the right way, but you do need someone who has either been through the process before,
who knows what they're talking about.
Because it is a sort of complicated, you know, and also it's really hard to explain, but you know, talking to you, I can put some of my personality and beliefs to you quite clearly, and I know how you're feeding back to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Because when you write it down, that is much more challenging.
Yeah,
you don't know who
you're not getting a reaction
going to come to it.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's trying to get your belief and personality without being sort of too, you know, too dogmatic would be a very good word to use here, wouldn't it? But you know, it's a very different process to verbal communication.
Yeah.
And that's something I hadn't really ever experienced before. I mean, I've written lots of essays and articles for about the charity, but to actually put your own thoughts down and think that somebody could be reading it somewhere else in the world and have a very different view or understanding. It's really quite challenging, actually.
Yeah,
quite a sort of experience.
So, do you think this is the first of this could be the first of many books? Are you thinking about doing anything else?
Actually, obviously, see how the interest is. But now I am feeling that there would be another book, because we are only partway through the journey, and I just, what we're going to learn next about what dogs can do and the ability to detect all these diseases, we're only just starting. And I've got Florin, she's like on the other side of me, so Florin is Daisy's niece, and she's training as a cancer dog now. So I think, you know, that there is going to be another story. There's there's going to be a second story about how Daisy's work, what Daisy's work led to, and I think that would be the next one, yeah.
Yeah, no, I just think it's an absolutely fascinating story. As I said, when we got the press release through, I was like, oh, I have to talk to this lady. It just sounds amazing. And there's obviously people out there that have been through cancer, or they've been diagnosed, and they're like, oh, you know, and they can kind of identify with your story.
Absolutely.
So I think there'll be a lot of people that are, do you know what I mean? Oh, this is kind of a bit like what I went through, you know, so I think you might get a few people like that. So if there's anybody out there that would like to contribute to Medical Detection Dogs or help in some way, how would you advise them to get in touch with yourselves?
Well, there's lots of different ways. I mean, obviously, you know, for most people these days, the website is the sort of main through. So that's www.medicaldetectiondogs, all one word, .org.uk. Or you can always give us a call on 01296 655 888. There's now lots of things going on around the country because, you know, we've got dogs placed around the country now. So there's lots of ways people can help and support and get involved. You know, we're a very new charity. We're not... sadly, charities have been hit by bad publicity.
Oh, definitely.
You know, being very aggressive and in their fundraising. We're not. You know, we have a family feel. We want people to help, get involved, but not feel under any pressure. We love what dogs are able to do for people, and we really, really enjoy having people helping us get there. So, you know, get in touch. And get involved, basically. I think those are the two things.
Yeah, yeah. Get you branched out into Ireland. You know what I mean? There's obviously...
Exactly,
I'd say
there's definitely
demand, you know?
Yeah, no, and we've just placed the first dual dog with Guide Dogs of Ireland. I think sorry if I got the title wrong. So that's a dog that guides someone, but also the person is very severe type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the first dual dog, and I think the publicity of that will be coming out soon, but we've really enjoyed working with them, and it's been a fantastic experience, and I think, as you say, there's a lot more that can be done.
Yeah. Ronnie, you've made the first step, do you know what I mean? It's just it can only go onwards and upwards from that. It only takes a few people to hear about it, and then they tell their friends, and then they tell their friends, and it's, you know, it's just it's crazy, isn't it? Anyway, how it works.
I know.
Thank you so much for talking to me today, Claire. It's been absolutely fantastic and really educational.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, and I hope if anybody does read the book, I hope they enjoy it.
Yes, I'm sure they will. As I said, I've not managed to get right through it at the moment, but I've started on it. It's just an absolutely fantastic read. And the fact that it's a true story as well is, you know, people love true stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Daisy's Gift by Claire Guest is published by Virgin Books, and it's available in all good bookshops from the 14th of July. So go out and get yourself a copy.